through Peshawar, seeking shelter in the nearby camps. Many of the refugees were casualties of the Soviet landmines or the intensive bombing of towns and cities, and they desperately needed medical treatment. The conditions in the hospitals and clinics were degrading, however, especially at the beginning of the war. Zawahiri reported home that he sometimes had to use honey to sterilize wounds. Writing to his mother, he complained of loneliness and pleaded for more frequent letters in return. In these notes, he would occasionally burst into poetry to express his despair. "She met my evil actions with goodness, without asking for any return. May God erase my ineptness and please her despite my offenses. O God, may you have pity on a stranger who longs for the sight of his mother." Through his connection with local tribal chiefs, Zawahiri made several furtive trips across the border into Afghanistan. He became one of the first outsiders to witness the courage of the Afghan freedom fighters who called themselves the Mujahideen, the Holy Warriors. That fall, Zawahiri returned to Cairo full of stories about the miracles that were taking place in the jihad against the Soviets. It was a war few knew much about, even in the Arab world, although it was by far the bloodiest conflict of the 1980s. Zawahiri began going around to universities recruiting for jihad. He had grown a beard and was affecting a Pakistani outfit, a long tunic over loose trousers. At this point, there was only a handful of Arab volunteers, and when a delegation of Mujahideen leaders came to Cairo, Zawahiri took his uncle Mahfouz to Shepherd's Hotel to meet them. The two men presented the Afghans with an idea that Abdullah Schleifer had proposed. Schleifer had been frustrated by the inability of Western news organizations to get close to the war. He had told Zawahiri to find him three bright young Afghans whom he could train as cameramen. That way, they could record their stories and Schleifer could provide the editing and narration. But he warned Zawahiri, "If we don't get the bang-bang, we don't get it on the air." Soon after that, Schleifer paid a call on Zawahiri to learn what had happened to his proposal. He found his friend strangely formal and evasive. Zawahiri began by saying that Americans were the enemy and must be confronted. "I don't understand," Schleifer replied. "You just came back from Afghanistan, where you're cooperating with the Americans. Now you're saying America's the enemy?" "Sure, we're taking American help to fight the Russians," Zawahiri responded, "but they're equally evil." "How can you make such a comparison?" said Schleifer, outraged. "There is more freedom to practice Islam in America than in Egypt, and in the Soviet Union they closed down 50,000 mosques."
"You don't see it because you're an American," said Zawahiri.
Schleifer angrily told him that the only reason they were even having this conversation was that NATO and the American army had kept the Soviets from overrunning Europe and then turning their attention to the Middle East. The discussion ended on a bad note. They had debated each other many times, but always with respect and humor. This time Schleifer had the feeling that Zawahiri wasn't talking to him. He was addressing a multitude. Nothing came of Schleifer's offer to instruct Afghan newsmen. Zawahiri returned for another tour of duty with the Red Crescent Society in Peshawar in March of 1981. This time, he cut short his stay and returned to Cairo after only 2 months. Later, he would write that he saw the Afghan jihad as a training course of the utmost importance to prepare the Muslim Mujahideen to wage their awaited battle against a superpower that now has sole dominance over the globe, namely, the United States. When Zawahiri returned to his medical practice in Mahdi, the Islamic world was still trembling from the political earthquakes of 1979, which included not only the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, but also the return of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini to Iran and the toppling of the Peacock Throne, the first successful Islamist takeover of a major country. When Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the exiled Shah of Iran, sought treatment for cancer in the United States, the Ayatollah incited student mobs to attack the American embassy in Tehran. Sadat regarded Khomeini as a lunatic madman who has turned Islam into a mockery. He invited the ailing Shah to take up residence in Egypt.
and the Shah died there the following year. For Muslims everywhere, Khomeini reframed the debate with the West. Instead of conceding the future of Islam to a secular democratic model, he imposed a stunning reversal. His intoxicating sermon summoned up the unyielding force of the Islam of a previous millennium in language that foreshadowed bin Laden's revolutionary diatribes. The specific target of his rage against the West was freedom. Yes, we are reactionaries, and you are enlightened intellectuals. You, intellectuals, do not want us to go back 1,400 years, he said soon after taking power. You who want freedom, freedom for everything, the freedom of parties. You who want all the freedoms, you intellectuals. Freedom that will corrupt our youth. Freedom that will pave the way for the oppressor. Freedom that will drag our nation to the bottom. As early as the 1940s, Khomeini had signaled his readiness to use terror to humiliate the perceived enemies of Islam, providing theological cover as well as material support. Islam says, whatever good there is exists thanks to the sword and in the shadow of the sword. People cannot be made obedient except with the sword. The sword is the key to paradise, which can be opened only for holy warriors. The fact that Khomeini came from the Shiite branch of Islam, rather than the Sunni, which predominates in the Muslim world outside of Iraq and Iran, made him a complicated figure among Sunni radicals. Nonetheless, Zawahiri's organization, Al-Jihad, supported the Iranian revolution with leaflets and cassette tapes urging all Islamic groups in Egypt to follow the Iranian example. The overnight transformation of a relatively wealthy, powerful, modern country such as Iran into a rigid theocracy showed that the Islamist dream was imminently achievable, and it quickened their desire to act. Islamism was by now a broad and variegated movement, including those who were willing to work within a political system such as the Muslim Brothers, and those like Zawahiri who wanted to wreck the state and impose a religious dictatorship. The main object of the Islamist struggle was to impose Islamic law, Sharia. They believe that the 500 Quranic verses that constitute the basis of Sharia are the immutable commandments of God, offering a road back to the perfected era of the Prophet and his immediate successors, although the legal code actually evolved several centuries after the Prophet's death. These verses comment upon behavior as precise and various as how to respond to someone who sneezes, and the permissibility of wearing gold jewelry. They also prescribe specific punishments for some crimes, such as adultery and drinking, but not for others, including homicide. Islamists say the Sharia cannot be improved upon, despite 15 centuries of social change, because it arises directly from the mind of God. They want to bypass the long tradition of judicial opinion from Muslim scholars and forge a more authentically Islamic legal system that is untainted by Western influence or any improvisations caused by the engagement with modernity. Non-Muslims and Islamic modernists, on the other hand, argue that the tenets of Sharia reflect the stringent Bedouin codes of the culture that gave birth to the religion, and are certainly not adequate to govern a modern society. Under Sadat, the government had repeatedly pledged to conform to Sharia, but his actions showed how little that promise could be trusted. Sadat's peace agreement with Israel united the disparate Islamist factions. They were also inflamed by a new law sponsored by the president's wife, Jahan, that granted women the right to divorce, a privilege not provided by the Quran. In what would prove to be his final speech, Sadat ridiculed the Islamic garb worn by pious women, which he called a tent, and banned the niqab from the universities. The radicals responded by characterizing the president as a heretic. It is forbidden, under Islamic law, to strike against a ruler unless he doesn't believe in God or the Prophet. The declaration of heresy was an open invitation to assassination. In response to a series of demonstrations orchestrated by the Islamists, Sadat dissolved all religious student associations, confiscated their property, and shut down their summer camps. Reversing his position of tolerating, even encouraging, such groups, he now adopted a new slogan, "No politics in religion and no religion in politics." There could scarcely have been a more incendiary formulation in the Islamist mind. Zawahiri envisioned not merely the removal of the head of state, but a complete overthrow of the existing order. Stealthily, he had been recruiting officers from the Egyptian military, waiting for the moment when al-Jihad had accumulated sufficient strength in men and weapons to act. His chief strategist was Abud al-Zumar, a colonel in military intelligence who was a hero of the 1973 war against Israel. A Cairo street had been renamed in his honor. Zumar's plan was to kill the main leaders of the country, capture the headquarters of the army and state security, the telephone exchange building, and of course the radio and television building, where news of the Islamic revolution would then be broadcast, unleashing, he expected, a popular uprising against secular authority all over the country. It was, Zawahiri later testified, an elaborate artistic plan. Another key member of Zawahiri's cell was a daring tank commander named Issam al-Qamari. Because of his valor and intelligence, Major Qamari had been promoted repeatedly over the heads of his peers. Zawahiri described him as a noble person in the true sense of the word. Most of his sufferings and sacrifices that he endured willingly and calmly were the result of his honorable character. Although Zawahiri was the senior member of the Mahdi cell, he often deferred to Qamari, who had a natural sense of command, a quality that Zawahiri notably lacked. Indeed, Qamari observed that there was something missing in Zawahiri, and once cautioned him, "If you are a member of any group, you cannot be the leader." Qamari began smuggling weapons and ammunition from army strongholds and storing them in Zawahiri's medical clinic in Mahdi, which was in a downstairs apartment in the duplex where his parents lived. In February of 1981, as the weapons were being transferred from the clinic to a warehouse, police officers arrested a young man carrying a bag loaded with guns, military bulletins, and maps that showed the location of all the tank emplacements in Cairo. Qamari, realizing he would soon be implicated, dropped out of sight, but several of his officers were arrested. Zawahiri inexplicably stayed put. Until these arrests, the Egyptian government had persuaded itself that the Islamist underground had been eliminated. That September, Sadat ordered the roundup of more than 1,500 people, including many prominent Egyptians, not only Islamists but also intellectuals with no religious leanings, Marxists, Coptic Christians, student leaders, journalists, writers, doctors in the Muslim Brothers Syndicate, a potpourri of dissidents from various sectors. The dragnet missed Zawahiri but captured most of the other leaders of al-Jihad. However, a military cell within the scattered ranks of Jihad had already set in motion a hasty and opportunistic plan. Lieutenant Khalid Islambouli, who was 23 years old, proposed to kill Sadat during an appearance at a military parade the following month. Zawahiri testified that he did not hear about the plan until 9 o'clock on the morning of October 6, 1981, a few hours before the assassination was scheduled to take place. One of the members of his cell, a pharmacist, brought him the news. "I was astonished and shaken," Zawahiri told his interrogators. The pharmacist proposed that they must do something to help the hastily conceived plot succeed. "But I told him, what can we do? Do they want us to shoot up the streets and let the police detain us? We are not going to do anything." Zawahiri went back to his patients. When he learned a few hours later that the military exhibition was still going on, he assumed that the operation had failed and everyone connected with it had been arrested. He then went to the home of one of his sisters, who informed him that the exhibition had been halted and the president had left unharmed. The real news was yet to be heard. Sadat had been celebrating the 8th anniversary of the 1973 war. Surrounded by dignitaries, including several American diplomats and Boutros Boutros-Ghali, the future Secretary General of the United Nations, Sadat was saluting the passing troops when a military vehicle veered toward the reviewing stand. Lieutenant Islambouli and three other conspirators leaped out and tossed grenades into the stand. "I have killed the Pharaoh," Islambouli cried, after emptying the cartridge of his machine gun into the president, who stood defiantly at attention until his body was riddled with bullets. The announcement of Sadat's death later that day met with little grief in the Arab world, which regarded him as a traitor for making peace with Israel. In Zawahiri's opinion, the assassination had accomplished nothing in the way of achieving an Islamic state. But perhaps there was still time, in the shaky interval following the event, to put the grand plan into effect. Issam al-Qamari came out of hiding and asked Zawahiri to put him in touch with the group that had carried out the assassination. At 10 that night, only 8 hours after Sadat's murder, Zawahiri and Qamari met with Abud al-Zumar in a car outside the apartment where Qamari was hiding. Qamari had a daring proposal, this one, with a chance to eliminate the entire government and many foreign leaders as well, an attack on Sadat's funeral. Zumar agreed and asked Qamari to supply him with 10 bombs and 2 guns. The very next day the group met again. Qamari brought the weapons as well as several boxes of ammunition. Meanwhile, the new government, headed by Hosni Mubarak, was rounding up thousands of prospective conspirators. Abud al-Zumar was arrested before the plan could be put into action. Zawahiri must have known that his name would surface, but still he lingered. On October 23rd, he had finally packed his belongings for another trip to Pakistan. He went to say goodbye to some relatives. His brother, Hussein, was driving him to the airport when the police stopped them on the Nile Corniche. They took Ayman to the Mahdi police station, and he was surrounded by guards, his cousin Omar Azam recalled. The chief of police slapped him on the face, and Ayman slapped him back. The family regards this incident with amazement, not only because of the recklessness of Zawahiri's response, but also because until that moment, he had never, in their memory, resorted to violence. Zawahiri immediately became known among the other prisoners as the man who struck back. Security forces greeted the incoming prisoners by stripping them naked, blindfolding and handcuffing them, then beating them with sticks. Humiliated, frightened, and disoriented, they were thrown into narrow stone cells, the only light coming from a tiny square window in the iron door. The dungeon had been built in the 12th century by the great Kurdish conqueror Saladin, using the labor of captured crusaders. It was part of the citadel, a massive fortress on a hill overlooking Cairo that had served as the seat of government for 700 years. The screams of fellow prisoners who were being interrogated kept many men in a state of near madness, even when they weren't tortured themselves. Because of his status, Zawahiri was subjected to frequent beatings and other ingenious and sadistic forms of punishment created by Intelligence Unit 75, which oversaw Egypt's Inquisition. One line of thinking proposes that America's tragedy on September 11th was born in the prisons of Egypt. Human rights advocates in Cairo argue that torture created an appetite for revenge, first inside Qutb and later in his acolytes, including Ayman al-Zawahiri. The main target of the prisoners' wrath was the secular Egyptian government, but a powerful current of anger was also directed toward the West, which they saw as an enabling force behind the repressive regime. They held the West responsible for corrupting and humiliating Islamic society. Indeed, the theme of humiliation, which is the essence of torture, is important to understanding the radical Islamist rage. Egypt's prisons became a factory for producing militants whose need for retribution, they called it justice, was all-consuming. Muntasir al-Zayat, an Islamist attorney who was imprisoned with Zawahiri and later became his lawyer and biographer, maintains that the traumatic experiences suffered by Zawahiri in prison transformed him from being a relatively moderate force in al-Jihad into a violent and implacable extremist. Zayat and other witnesses point to what happened to his relationship with Issam al-Qamari, who had been his close friend and a man he keenly admired. Immediately after Zawahiri's arrest, officers in the Interior Ministry began grilling him about Major Comrie, who continued to slip their nets. He was now the most wanted man in Egypt. He had already survived a firefight with grenades and automatic weapons in which many policemen were killed or wounded. In their relentless search for Comrie, the security officers booted the distinguished Zawahiri family out of their house and tore up the floors and pulled down all the wallpaper, looking for evidence. They also waited by the phone, betting that eventually the desperado would call. 2 weeks later, the call finally came. The caller identified himself as Dr. Assam and asked to meet Zawahiri. Comrie was unaware that Zawahiri was in custody when he phoned, since it had been kept secret. A police officer, pretending to be a family member, told Dr. Assam that Zawahiri was not there. The caller suggested, "Let him pray the Maghreb, the sunset prayer, with me, at a mosque they both knew." Comrie had given him an appointment on the road to Mahdi, but he noticed the security people and he escaped again, said Fuad Alam, who was the head of the Interior Ministry's anti-terrorism unit at the time. He is an avuncular figure with a basso profundo voice, who has interrogated almost every major Islamic radical since 1965, when he questioned Said Qutb. "I called Ayman al-Zawahiri to my office in order to propose a plan." Alam found Zawahiri shy and distant. "He doesn't look at you when he talks, which is a sign of politeness in the Arab world." According to Zawahiri's uncle Mahfouz, Zawahiri had already been brutally tortured, and he actually came to Alam's office wearing only one shoe because of an injury inflicted to his foot. Alam arranged to have Zawahiri's telephone line transferred into his office, and he held Zawahiri there until Comrie finally called again. This time Zawahiri answered and made a date to meet at the Zuaya Mosque in Mbaba. As planned, Zawahiri went to the mosque and fingered his friend. Zawahiri himself doesn't admit to this in his memoir, except obliquely, where he writes about the humiliation of imprisonment. "The toughest thing about captivity is forcing the mujahid, under the force of torture, to confess about his colleagues, to destroy his movement with his own hands, and offer his and his colleagues' secrets to the enemy." Perversely, the authorities placed Comrie in the same cell with Zawahiri after Zawahiri testified against him and 13 others. Comrie received a 10-year sentence. As usual, he received the news with his unique calmness and self-composure, Zawahiri recorded. "He even tried to comfort me and said, 'I pity you for the burdens you will carry.'" In 1988, Comrie was shot to death by police after escaping from prison. Zawahiri was defendant number 113 of 302 who were accused of aiding or planning the assassination, as well as various other crimes in Zawahiri's case dealing in arms. Lieutenant Islambouli and 23 others charged with the actual assassination were tried separately. Islambouli and 4 conspirators were hanged. Nearly every notable Islamist in Egypt was implicated in the plot. The other defendants, some of whom were adolescents, were crowded into a zoo-like cage that ran across one side of a vast improvised courtroom in the exhibition grounds in Cairo, where fairs and conventions are often held. They came from various organizations, Al-Jihad, the Islamic Group, the Muslim Brotherhood, that formed the fractious core of the Islamist movement. International news organizations covered the trial, and Zawahiri, who had the best command of English among the defendants, was their designated spokesman. Video footage of the opening day of the trial, December 4, 1982, shows the 300 defendants, illuminated by the lights of the TV cameras, chanting, praying, and calling out desperately to family members. Finally, the camera settles on Zawahiri, who stands apart from the chaos, with a look of solemn, focused intensity. 31 years old, he is wearing a white robe and has a gray scarf thrown over his shoulder. At a signal, the other prisoners fall silent and Zawahiri cries out, "Now we want to speak to the whole world. Who are we? Why do they bring us here? And what we want to say?" about the first question, we are Muslims. We are Muslims who believe in their religion. We are Muslims who believe in their religion, both in ideology and practice, and hence we tried our best to establish an Islamic state and an Islamic society. The other defendants chant in Arabic, there is no God but God. Zawafri continues in a fiercely repetitive cadence. We are not sorry, we are not sorry for what we have done for our religion, and we have sacrificed, and we stand ready to make more sacrifices. The others shout, there is no God but God. Zawafri then says, we are here, the real Islamic front and the real Islamic opposition against Zionism, communism, and imperialism. He pauses then. And now, as an answer to the second question, why did they bring us here? They bring us here for two reasons. First, they are trying to abolish the outstanding Islamic movement. And secondly, to complete the conspiracy of evacuating the area in preparation for the Zionist infiltration. The others cry out, we will not sacrifice the blood of Muslims for the Americans and the Jews. The prisoners pull off their shoes and raise their robes to expose marks of torture. Zawafri talks about the abuse that took place in the dirty Egyptian jails where we suffered the severest inhuman treatment. There they kicked us, they beat us, they whipped us with the electric cables, they shocked us with electricity, they shocked us with electricity, and they used the wild dogs, and they used the wild dogs, and they hung us over the edges of the doors. Here he bends forward to demonstrate, with our hands tied at the back. They arrested the wives, the mothers, the fathers, the sisters, and the sons. The defendants chant, the army of Muhammad will return and we will defeat the Jews. The camera captures one particularly wild-eyed defendant in a green kaftan as he extends his arms through the bars of the cage, screams, and then faints into the arms of a fellow prisoner. Zawafri calls out the names of several prisoners, who he says died as a result of torture. So where is democracy? He shouts. Where is freedom? Where is human rights? Where is justice? Where is justice? We will never forget. We will never forget. Zawafri's allegations of torture were later substantiated by forensic medical reports, which noted 6 injuries in various places on his body resulting from assaults with a solid instrument. Zawafri later testified in a case brought against Intelligence Unit 75, which had conducted the prison interrogations. He was supported by the testimony of one of the intelligence officers who confessed that he witnessed Zawafri in the prison, his head shaved, his dignity completely humiliated, undergoing all sorts of torture. The officer went on to say that he had been in the interrogation room when another prisoner was brought into the chamber, chained hand and foot. The interrogators were trying to get Zawafri to confess his involvement in the Sadat assassination. When the other prisoner said, how would you expect him to confess when he knows the penalty is death? Zawafri replied, the death penalty is more merciful than torture. The trial dragged on for 3 years. Sometimes the defendants would go every day, but then more than a month might pass before they returned to the improvised courtroom. They were from various groups, and many had not even known of the other's existence before they found themselves locked up together. They naturally began to conspire. While some eagerly talked about rebuilding, there were also intensive discussions among the prisoners about the dismaying fact that so many of them had been arrested, the movement so quickly betrayed. We were defeated, and so we became lost, Zawafri admitted to one of his prison mates. They spent many days considering why the underground operations had failed and how they might have succeeded. Ayman told me that he hadn't wanted the Sadat assassination to take place, Muntasir al-Sayyad, his fellow prisoner and biographer, recalled. He thought they should have waited and plucked the regime from the roots through a military coup. He was not that bloodthirsty. His education, family background, and relative wealth made Zawafri a notable figure. Every other day, a driver arrived with food from his family, which Zawafri distributed among the other prisoners. He also helped out in the prison hospital. During this time, Zawafri came face to face with Egypt's best-known Islamists, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, who had also been charged as a conspirator in the Sadat assassination. A strange and forceful man, blinded by diabetes in childhood, but blessed with a stirring, resonant voice, Sheikh Omar had risen in Islamic circles because of his eloquent denunciations of Nasser, who had tossed him in jail for 8 months without charges. After Nasser's death, the blind sheikh's influence increased, especially in Upper Egypt, where he taught theology at the Assyut branch of Al-Azhar University. He developed a following among the students and became the leader of the Islamic group. Some of the young Islamists were financing their activism by shaking down Coptic Christians, who made up perhaps 10% of the Egyptian population, but who included many shopkeepers and small business owners. On a number of occasions, the young radicals stormed into Coptic weddings and robbed the guests. The theology of jihad requires a fatwa, a religious ruling, in order to consecrate actions that would otherwise be considered criminal. Sheikh Omar obligingly issued fatwas that countenanced the slaughter of Christians and the plunder of Coptic jewelry stores on the premise that a state of war existed between Christians and Muslims. After Sadat finally attempted to rein in the Islamists, the blind sheikh took a 3-year sojourn to Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries, where he found wealthy sponsors for his cause. When he returned to Egypt in 1980, he was not merely the spiritual advisor of the Islamic group, he was the emir. In one of Sheikh Omar's first fatwas, he declared that a heretical leader deserved to be killed by the faithful. At his trial for conspiring in the assassination of Sadat, his lawyer successfully convinced the court that, because his client had not mentioned the Egyptian president by name, he was, at most, tangential to the plot. 6 months after the sheikh's imprisonment, he was released. Although members of the two leading militant organizations, the Islamic group and al-Jihad, shared the common goal of bringing down the government, they differed sharply in their ideology and tactics. The blind sheikh preached that all humanity could embrace Islam, and he was content to spread this message. Zawahiri profoundly disagreed. Distrustful of the masses and contemptuous of any faith other than his own stark version of Islam, he preferred to act secretly and unilaterally until the moment his group could seize power and impose its totalitarian religious vision. The Islamic group and al-Jihad had collaborated under the leadership of Sheikh Omar, but those from al-Jihad, including Qamari and Zawahiri, sought to have one of their own in charge. In the Cairo prison, members of the two organizations had heated debates about the best way to achieve a true Islamic revolution, and they quarreled endlessly over who was the best man to lead it. Zawahiri pointed out that Sharia states that the emir cannot be blind. Sheikh Omar countered that Sharia also decrees that the emir cannot be a prisoner. The rivalry between the two men became extreme. Zayat tried to moderate Zawahiri's attacks on the sheikh, but Zawahiri refused to back down. The result was that al-Jihad and the Islamic group split apart once more. They would remain polarized by these two intransigent personalities. Zawahiri was convicted of dealing in weapons and received a 3-year sentence, which he had nearly finished serving by the time the trial concluded. Perhaps in response to his cooperation in testifying against other defendants, the government dropped several additional charges against him. Released in 1984, Zawahiri emerged a hardened radical whose beliefs had been hammered into brilliant resolve. Saad Din Ibrahim, a prominent sociologist at the American University in Cairo, spoke to Zawahiri soon after he got out of prison, and he noted a pronounced degree of suspicion and an overwhelming desire for revenge, which was characteristic of men who have been abused in prison. Torture may have had other unanticipated effects on these intensely religious men. Many of them said that after being tortured, they had had visions of being welcomed by the saints into paradise and of the just Islamic society that had been made possible by their martyrdom. Ibrahim had done a study of political prisoners in Egypt in the 1970s. According to his research, most of the Islamist recruits were young men from villages who had come to the city for schooling. The majority were the sons of middle-level government bureaucrats. They were ambitious and tended to be drawn to the fields of science and engineering, which accept only the most qualified students. They were not the alienated, marginalized youth that a sociologist might have expected. Instead, Ibrahim wrote, they were model young Egyptians. If they were not typical, it was because they were significantly above the average in their generation. Ibrahim attributed the recruiting success of the militant Islamist groups to their emphasis on brotherhood, sharing, and spiritual support, which provided a soft landing for the rural migrants to the city. Zawahiri, who had read the study in prison, heatedly disagreed. He asserted that the recruits responded to the Islamist ideals, not to the social needs that the groups attended. You have trivialized our movement by your mundane analysis, he told Ibrahim. May God have mercy on you. Ibrahim responded to Zawahiri's challenge by recalling an old Arabic saying, for everyone who tries, there is a reward. If he hits it right, he gets two rewards. But if he misses, he still gets a reward for trying. Zawahiri smiled and said, you get one reward. Once again, Dr. Zawahiri resumed his surgical practice. However, he was worried about the political consequences of his testimony in the torture case against Intelligence Unit 75. He thought of applying for a surgery fellowship in England. He arranged to work at the Ibn al-Nafis Clinic in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, even though the Egyptian government had forbidden him to leave the country for 3 years. Zawahiri secured a tourist visa to Tunisia, perhaps using a false passport. It seems obvious that he did not intend to return. He had shaved his beard after his release, which indicated that he was returning to his underground work. As he was leaving, he ran into his friend Abdullah Schleifer at the Cairo airport. Where are you going? Schleifer asked. Saudi, Zawahiri confided. He appeared relaxed and happy. The two men embraced. Listen, Ayman, stay out of politics, Schleifer warned. I will, Zawahiri replied. I will. Chapter 3. The Founder. At the age of 34, Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri was a formidable figure. He had been a committed revolutionary and the leader of an underground Islamist cell for more than half his life. His political skills had been honed by endless prison debates, and he emerged pious, bitter, and determined. Saudi intelligence says that he arrived in the kingdom in 1985 on a pilgrimage visa, which he converted to a work visa. He spent about a year practicing medicine in the Ibn al-Nafis Clinic in Jeddah. Zawahiri's sister Heba, a professor of oncology at the National Cancer Institute at Cairo University, said that during this period he passed the first part of an examination for a surgery fellowship he was seeking in England. His mother and other members of his family were under the impression that he was planning to return to Cairo eventually because he continued to pay rent on his clinic in Mahdi. His brother Muhammad was also in the kingdom working as an architect in Medina. Zawahiri's attorney and former prison mate, Montasser al-Zayat, passed through Jeddah on his way to Mecca, and he found Zawahiri sober and downcast. The scars left on his body from the indescribable torture he suffered caused him no more pain, Zayat later wrote, but his heart still ached from it. In Zayat's opinion, Zawahiri had fled Egypt because the guilt of betraying his friends weighed so oppressively on his conscience. By testifying against his comrades while he was in prison, Zawahiri had lost his claim to leadership of al-Jihad. He was looking for a place where he could redeem himself and where the radical Islamist movement could gain a foothold. The situation in Egypt had been getting worse, Zawahiri later wrote. You can say explosive. Jeddah was the commercial center of the kingdom, the port of entry for the millions of pilgrims who pass through on their way to Mecca each year. Every Muslim who is capable of making the journey, called the Hajj, is required to do so at least once. Some who remained became the founders of the great banking and merchant families, the Bin Mahfouzes, the Ali Reises, and Khashoggis among them, who could trace their immigrant roots to Yemen and Persia and Turkey. This cosmopolitan heritage set the city apart from the culturally and ethnically isolated interior. Here, in Jeddah, it was the families, not the tribes, that mattered. And among the handful of names that dominated Jeddah society was that of bin Laden. Zayat contends that Zawafri and bin Laden met in Jeddah, and although there is no record of their first encounter, it is certainly likely. Zawafri had already been to Afghanistan twice before prison, and intended to return as soon as possible. The pipeline to Afghanistan ran directly through bin Laden's apartment. Anyone who gave money or volunteered for the jihad would have known the enterprising young Saudi. In any case, they were bound to discover each other sooner or later in the intimate landscape of jihad. In Arabic, the name Jeddah means grandmother, and according to legend, the city's name refers to Eve, the grandmother of the human race, who is said to be buried in a spacious walled compound in the working-class neighborhood where Osama bin Laden grew up. In the 12th century, a cult formed around her supposed tomb, which traced the remains of her giant body, nearly 500 feet long, marked by a domed shrine where her navel was said to be. Sir Richard Burton visited the grave in 1853 and surveyed the dimensions, remarking, "If our first parent measured 120 paces from head to waist and 80 from waist to heel, she must have presented much the appearance of a duck." The Wahhabis, the creed-bound sect that predominates in Saudi Arabia, who condemn the veneration of tombs, knocked the place down in 1928, soon after they occupied Jeddah, and today it is a typical Wahhabi graveyard, with long rows of featureless, unmarked graves like unplanted flower beds. Osama bin Laden's father was buried here after his death in an air crash in 1967, at the age of 59. One cannot understand the scale of the son's ambition without appreciating the father's accomplishment. Remote and powerful but humble in manner, Muhammad bin Awad bin Laden was a legend even before Osama was born. He presented a formidable model to a young man who idolized him and hoped to equal, if not surpass, his achievements. Muhammad had been born in a remote valley in central Yemen. This region, which is called the Hadramut, is known for its ethereal mud-brick towers like sandcastles that rise as high as 12 stories. These fantastic constructions have given the Hadramis their reputation as builders and architects. Mainly, however, the Hadramut is famous for the people who have left it. For millennia, they have worn a path through the empty quarter of southern Arabia and then along the Sahar Mountains guarding the eastern coast of the Red Sea and into the Hejaz, the land where Islam was born. From there, many of them fanned out into the Levant and southeastern Asia, even into the Philippines, forming a broad fraternity of merchants, businessmen, and contractors. A catastrophic drought in the early 1930s cast thousands of Hadramis out of their country to seek not merely opportunities, but existence itself. Muhammad was among them. After spending a brief time in Ethiopia, he took a boat to Jizan on the southern Arabian coast, and from there he joined a camel caravan to Jeddah. He was 23 years old when he arrived. Arabia in 1931 was one of the poorest, most desolate places in the world. It was not yet unified. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia did not formally come into existence until the following year. The ruler of this fractious desert empire was Abdulaziz bin Abdul Rahman bin Faisal Al Saud, who lived in Riyadh in a modest palace made of mud brick. He had just put down a vicious revolt by a group of religious fanatics called the Ikhwan, a direct predecessor of Al-Qaeda. They had once formed Abdulaziz's own shock troops, massacring thousands of innocent and unarmed villagers in their campaign to purify the peninsula in the name of Islam. The king tried to control the Ikhwan, attempting to prevent their murderous rays from spilling over into neighboring countries. The Ikhwan already detested the king's alliance with Britain and his extravagantly polygamous lifestyle, but they decisively turned against him because of his attempt to bridle jihad, which to them was limitless and obligatory, their duty to God. Abdulaziz had to get the permission of the religious establishment to rein in the murderous zealots. This was the defining political moment of modern Saudi Arabia. By awarding the king the sole power to declare jihad, the Wahhabi clerics reaffirmed their position as the arbiters of power in a highly religious society. The king finally defeated the Ikhwan's camel-mounted corps with the help of motor cars, machine guns, and British bombers. But the tension between the royal family and religious fanatics was a part of the social dynamic of modern Saudi Arabia from the very beginning. Most Saudis reject the name Wahhabi. They either call themselves Muwahideen, Unitarians, since the essence of their belief is the oneness of God, or Salafists, which refers to their predecessors, Salaf, the venerated companions of the Prophet. The founder of the movement, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, was an 18th century revivalist who believed that Muslims had drifted away from the true religion as it had been expressed during the golden age of the Prophet and his immediate successors. Among other theological innovations, Abdul Wahhab believed that God clothed himself in a human form. He rejected the intercessory prayer of saints and expressions of reverence for the dead, and he demanded that Muslim men refuse to trim their beards. He banned holidays, even the Prophet's birthday, and his followers destroyed many of the holy sites, which he considered idols. He attacked the arts as being frivolous and dangerous. He gave a warrant to his followers that they could kill or rape or plunder those who refused to follow his injunctions. Other Muslims in Arabia at the time considered Abdul Wahhab a dangerous heretic. In 1744, driven out of the Najd, the central part of the peninsula, he sought protection from Muhammad bin Saud, the founder of the first Saudi state. Although the Ottomans soon crushed the Saudis, the partnership that was formed with Abdul Wahhab and bin Saud's descendants persevered. The essence of their understanding was that there was no difference between religion and government. Abdul Wahhab's extreme views would always be a part of the fabric of Saudi rule. There was a second Saudi state in the 19th century which quickly fell apart because of family infighting. When Abdulaziz returned the Saudis to power in the 20th century for a third time, the doctrines of Abdul Wahhab became the official state religion, and no other forms of Islamic worship were permitted. This was done in the name of the Prophet, who had decreed that there should be only one religion in Arabia. In the blinkered view of the Wahhabis, there was only one interpretation of Islam, Salafism, and all other schools of Muslim thought were heretical. Mohammed bin Laden's career traced the same gradual, then suddenly explosive growth as Saudi Arabia. When he arrived in 1931, the nascent kingdom was in a state of perilous economic decline. The main source of revenue had been the annual stream of pilgrims coming for Hajj in the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. But the Great Depression had choked off the flow of pilgrims and devastated even the modest income derived from the export of dates. The country's future promised to be, at best, as dreary and obscure as its past. At the king's desperate invitation, an American geologist, Carl Twitchell, had arrived in April of that same year to probe for water and gold. He would find neither, but he did think there was some potential for oil. Twitchell's discovery opened the way for the partnership that eventually came to be known as the Arabian American Oil Company, Aramco. Over the next few years, a small colony of petroleum engineers and roughnecks set up an oil camp in the eastern province. Aramco was a modest enterprise at first, but there was so little economic life in the kingdom that the company quickly dominated the development of the entire country. Mohammed bin Laden, who had begun as a dock worker in Jeddah, managed to get a job with Aramco, working as a bricklayer in Dahran. The first great oil boom in the early 1950s ignited the transformation of this barren peninsula. Desert princes who had lived all their lives on dates and camel's milk were suddenly docking their yachts in Monaco. But the wealth wasn't being entirely squandered in the casinos of the Riviera, despite the Saudis' new reputation as international spendthrifts. Foreign contracting giants, especially the American firm Bechtel, brought their behemoth machinery to the kingdom and set about building the roads and schools and hospitals and ports and power plants that would give the kingdom the facade of modernity. Aramco commissioned most of these early projects. No country had ever experienced such rapid, overwhelming transformation. Bin Laden's fortunes began to lift as the American engineers, under pressure from the Saudi government to train and hire more local workers, began giving him projects that were too modest for the major firms. He was quickly recognized as an exacting and honest builder. He was a small, handsome man with one glass eye, the result of a blow a teacher had given him in his first days of schooling. Bin Laden never returned to school, and as a result he was illiterate. His signature was like that of a kid, one of his sons remembered. He was nonetheless brilliant with figures, which he could effortlessly calculate in his head, and he never forgot a measurement. An American who knew him in the 1950s described him as dark, friendly, and energetic. Aramco began a program that granted employees a leave for a year in order to try their luck in business. If they failed, they could return to the company with no loss in status. The Mohammed bin Laden Company was one of many enterprises that got its start with Aramco sponsorship. Bin Laden insisted on working side by side with his men, which created strong ties of loyalty. "I was raised as a laborer, and I love work and living with the laborers," he said. "If it were not for my love of work, I would never have succeeded." He also knew the value of holding a team together, so he would sometimes accept unprofitable projects just to keep his men on the job. They called him Mu'allim, a word that means both craftsman and teacher. Bin Laden was renovating houses in Jeddah when his work caught the eye of the Minister of Finance, Sheikh Abdullah bin Suleiman. The minister lauded his skills to King Abdulaziz. Years later, Osama bin Laden would recall how his father won the favor of the old king, who was now largely confined to his wheelchair, and wanted to add a ramp so that his automobile could be driven to his bedroom on the second floor of the Khozam Palace in Jeddah. When Mohammed bin Laden finished the job, he personally drove the king's car up the ramp to show that it would support the weight. In gratitude, the king awarded him contracts to build several new royal palaces, including the first concrete building in Riyadh. Eventually, the king made him an honorary minister of public works. As bin Laden's reputation grew, he became increasingly close to the royal family and responsive to their whims. Unlike those who ran the foreign firms, he was willing to abruptly break off one job to build another. He was patient when the royal treasury was empty, and he never turned down a job. His loyalty was rewarded when a British contractor defaulted on a project to build a highway between Jeddah and Medina. The finance minister gave the job to bin Laden and agreed to pay the same fee that would have been paid to the foreign company. Saudi Arabia needed roads. Even into the 50s, there was only one well-paved road from Riyadh to Dhahran. Bin Laden looked at his giant rival, Bechtel, and realized that without equipment, he could never compete for the really important contracts. He began acquiring machinery, and within a very brief span of time, he was the largest customer of Caterpillar earth-moving equipment in the world. From now on, he would build nearly every important road in the kingdom. His old sponsor, Aramco, donated the asphalt free of charge. Bin Laden moved with his family to Jeddah. When Umm Kulthum, the most popular singer in the Arab world, visited the Prophet's mosque in Medina, she was alarmed by the creaky columns and the cracks in the vaulted ceilings. She began raising money for repairs, which galled the old king. He ordered bin Laden to fix the problem. The original mosque, made of mud brick and tree trunks, had been constructed in 622 CE and expanded on several occasions, but it had not been designed to accommodate pilgrims by the millions. Bin Laden tripled the size of the Prophet's mosque during the first renovation, which got underway in 1953. But that was just the beginning of Mohammed bin Laden's imprint on the holiest places in Islam. One of King Abdulaziz's sons, Prince Talal, was the finance minister during the renovation of the Prophet's mosque. He tried to impose some order on the process, but bin Laden was used to working without supervision, keeping his figures in his head and answering to no one but the king. Talal was shocked to find that he had not even filed the proper legal papers to begin construction. "We have to organize this," Talal complained. Bin Laden refused. He said he would do it his way or walk off the job. Prince Talal decided to create a council nominally headed by the king himself to oversee the renovation. Then he offered to put bin Laden on the council. It was not really correct for him to be a part of the same body that was supposed to supervise him, Talal admitted. Fortunately, he agreed. If I had stood my ground against him, the king would have asked me to leave and kept bin Laden. After the death of Abdulaziz in November 1953, he was succeeded by Saud, his eldest son, who set a standard for wasteful extravagance, creating a new Saudi stereotype almost single-handedly as he rode through the sandy streets, throwing money into the air. The restraints, such as they were, against royal opportunism, dropped away as members of the royal family muscled their way into all the contracts, commissions, concessions, and franchises they could get their hands on, despite the fact that they were already being lavishly supported by the oil allowances they awarded themselves. It was, however, a wonderful time to be in the construction business. King Saud was on a building spree. Palaces, universities, pipelines, desalination plants, airports. And bin Laden's company was growing at a fantastic rate. In 1954, the seat of government moved from Jeddah to Riyadh, which involved building an entire bureaucratic complex, as well as the embassies, hotels, residences, and highways that would accompany the new capital. The treasury was so overextended that the government had to pay bin Laden by giving him the Hotel Al-Yamama, one of the 2 5-star hotels in Riyadh at the time. Through clever alliances with powerful foreign corporations, bin Laden began diversifying. Bin Laden Kaiser became one of the largest engineering and construction companies in the world. Bin Laden IMCO manufactured precast concrete for mosques, hotels, hospitals, and stadiums. Al-Midhar bin Laden Development Company provided consulting for foreign companies seeking entry into the Saudi market. Bin Laden Telecommunications Company represented Bell Canada, which got the plum government contracts in this field. Saudi Traffic Safety, another joint venture, was the largest highway lane marking company in the world. The empire grew to include manufacturing plants for brick, doors, windows, insulation, concrete, scaffolding, elevators, and air conditioners. It was during this period that the monumental, almost Stalinist Saudi architectural style began to assert itself. The immense, sometimes intimidating spaces fashioned of pre-stressed concrete announced the arrival in history of a new great power. And it was the Saudi bin Laden Group, as the company came to be called, that defined this colossal and highly ornamental aesthetic, which reached its apogee in the renovation of the Grand Mosque in Mecca, the most prestigious construction contract that could ever be granted in the kingdom. Surrounded by the lunar foothills of the Al-Sarawat Escarpment, which shield the city from the eyes of non-believers, Mecca arose at the intersection of 2 ancient caravan routes and served as a depot for silk, spices, and perfumes from Asia and Africa on their way to the Mediterranean. Even before the advent of Islam, this important trading center was esteemed as a holy site by virtue of the empty cubical building called the Kaaba. In Muslim tradition, the Kaaba is the center of the planet, the focus of all Muslim prayer. It is said that Adam laid the first stone and that the structure was rebuilt by the prophet Abraham in the Jewish and Christian traditions, and his son Ishmael, the forefather of the Arabs,